Kevin and Lenny. The list of cohorts with whom Kevin was ordered not to associate was comprehensive. It included Roscoe, Susan, Stephen Rhodes, and Mark Ross. Kevin also had strict orders to stay away from all phone freaks in general. In effect, his circle of acquaintances was pared considerably. But there was always Lenny. Lenny DeSico had never been attracted to phone freaking, or trashing, or even social engineering. His was a fascination with buttons. As a little boy in Oak Park outside of Chicago, Lenny wouldn't bother with a toy unless it had a knob to turn or a lever to push. Even as a toddler, he had a knack for finding the switch to stop an elevator between floors or the button that would halt an escalator. When he was 5, he managed to activate the fire alarm of one of Chicago's largest hospitals, sending nurses and physicians scurrying through the halls. But to his parents, Lenny's compulsion to play with gadgets was an enigma. Gilbert DeSico was an illustrator at the Chicago Tribune. Vera DeSico was an artist, too. Their only child eschewed crayons in favor of toys with moving parts and motors. When Gil DeSico took an illustrating job with a San Fernando Valley newspaper in 1977, the family moved to Los Angeles. In his very first minutes in Los Angeles, 12-year-old Lenny exhibited surprising enterprise. As Gil and Lenny waited for Gil's brother to pick them up at the airport, Lenny discovered that a quarter was refunded for each rental cart returned to the automated dispatcher. For half an hour, Lenny ran furiously around inside the terminal, rounding up stray carts and collecting the refunds. An auspicious omen, thought Gil, for starting their new life. Lenny enrolled at Sepulveda Junior High School in Mission Hills. His former introduction to computers came at Monroe High School in John Christ's introductory computer class. Lenny demonstrated an intuitive understanding of the labyrinthine integrated circuits around which computers were built, and an aptitude for programming. It was the start of the personal computer era, and he developed a passion for computing, and like many his age, the gangly teenager also displayed a special interest in communicating with remote systems over telephones. When Lenny managed to log on one day to the school district's central computer, Christ could only chuckle. 2 years earlier, a student of Christ's had demonstrated the same talent by using the simple classroom terminal to access the school district's digital equipment computer system. His name was Kevin Mitnick. He had dropped out of high school and taken an equivalency test for his diploma. "Oh, no," Christ groaned and smiled at Lenny. "Not another Kevin." Nothing could have pleased Lenny more. Lenny knew of Kevin Mitnick, who was something of a legend in Los Angeles high school computing circles. As a student at Monroe, Mitnick had absorbed information like no student before him. His telephone company exploits had been described at length in the Los Angeles Times. By Mitnick's own account to the FBI, the paper reported he and his friends had gained unauthorized access to computers all over the United States, systems supposedly impenetrable to all but selected people who know the passwords. Mitnick also told the FBI that he had obtained sensitive data from the ARC, one of the main systems in Digital's software development group. In suburban Southern California, where high school heroes traditionally emerged on the gridiron, Kevin had been the perfect antihero, a nerd who used technical wizardry to befuddle the authorities. There seemed to be no end to his clever tricks. While at Monroe, Kevin had reconfigured a modem line so that he could use it to dial out of the school's main computer and into others. The modification gave him a perfect cover for his activities. Anybody who attempted to trace the phone calls would inevitably run into a cold trail at the computer center. Lenny first met Mitnick in 1980 when a mutual friend introduced them. Lenny and his friend were on their way to a conference of an organization for digital equipment customers called DECUS. They had stopped by Kevin's house to invite him to come along. He declined, but asked them to keep their eyes out for interesting literature. National DECUS meetings usually attract as many as 20,000 digital users from around the country. For high school students to be intrigued by digital computers was unusual enough, but for them to go out of their way to attend a DECUS convention was a sign of extreme dedication. Mingling with the attendees, they could be as anonymous as they pleased. The convention hall was a sea of terminals, clustered within exhibition booths that demonstrated the latest in digital computers, software, and product literature. The day after his trip to the Dacus meeting, Lenny got a call from Kevin, who asked if he could get copies of the manuals Lenny had picked up. Lenny had finally met someone whose unusual passion matched his own. Like Lenny, Kevin Mitnick displayed little respect for his elders and even less for the institutions over which they presided. Someone had told Lenny that when Kevin was an adolescent, his mother had so much trouble controlling him, she sent him to a disciplinary camp for incorrigible children. On top of the much-publicized Cosmos incident, Mitnick had gained notoriety for breaking into computers at college campuses around Los Angeles. Lenny knew he was dealing with a veteran, and although Lenny was learning his way around Computer Underground quickly, he knew he still had a long way to go. Lessons from Kevin were far more interesting than anything Monroe High School had to offer. Lenny had always found school a useless bore. His attendance record at school was already spotty, and once he met Kevin, it got worse. Kevin had a lot of time on his hands. He was working as a delivery boy at Froman's, a delicatessen in the heart of the San Fernando Valley, owned by Arnold Froman, who was living with Kevin's mother in Panorama City. Hungry for a terminal to use, the pair discovered the San Fernando Valley's Radio Shack stores. Each store had a demonstration model of a personal computer called the TRS-80. Because the computers were also used to send inventory updates each evening to Radio Shack's Fort Worth headquarters, they were equipped with modems as well. Lenny and Kevin merely had to supply a communications software program to transform one of these computers into a full-fledged terminal. Using stolen MCI codes, they could dial long distance into any computer they could find. Kevin's initial method was to talk someone out of a password. Once he was in, he no longer needed to employ his verbal skills. What were supposed to be 5-minute demonstrations became marathon 6-hour reconnaissance sessions. Kevin sometimes pushed his luck, imploring a manager to keep his store open well past closing time. They could last for about a month at each store. When a manager got irked enough by their constant presence to ask them to take their hobby elsewhere, they simply combed the yellow pages for new possibilities. They became techno-nomads. The two teenagers turned their attention to the University of Southern California. Kevin had already been caught fiddling with computers on the USC campus a couple of years earlier, but as usually happened on the college campuses where he was caught, he was counseled and released. When he returned with Lenny at his side in 1982, no one recognized him. Kevin already knew the locations of campus terminal rooms that stayed open 24 hours a day, available to anyone who could pass as a student. Both Lenny and Kevin were largely self-taught, and they were still learning. Most of what they picked up about computers came not from time spent in classrooms or computer labs, but from hours spent with whatever system they could steal some time on. Most of the time, the computers were digital systems, the most popular computers on college campuses, so it wasn't surprising that the computers they came to know best were digital. By the early 1980s, Digital had augmented its PDP series of minicomputers with the VAX line. VAX stands for Virtual Address Extension, which refers to a way to expand memory that speeds a computer's performance. These computers were designed in such a way that all models could use the same software and share data over computer networks. With the VAX, Digital strengthened its position in the commercial market and started competing successfully in the banking, insurance, and accounting markets, traditional IBM strongholds. But Digital still had its roots in the technical and university community. And as its loyal customers at universities such as USC migrated to the VAX, so did Kevin and Lenny. Freaking as an end in itself had never done much for Lenny. His affinity for the telephone began and ended with his frequent lengthy conversations with friends. He felt uneasy about misrepresenting himself in order to get information or coerce a password out of someone. And as Lenny didn't have Kevin's appetite for electronic revenge, Kevin used phone company computers to wage his private wars against whoever he thought had crossed him. Lenny watched one evening as Kevin attached a local hospital's $30,000 telephone bill to the home phone of a fellow ham radio buff whom Kevin disliked. But there was something that drew him to Kevin. His own reluctance notwithstanding, Lenny was intrigued by Kevin's ability to feign and cajole his way around almost any phone company office or even a police department. Kevin could call someone at a switching office, for example, and convince him to drive 15 miles just to turn a computer on. The secret lay in convincing the person on the other end of the line that he was the supervisor of that person's supervisor. He would gain that person's trust by speaking the same language. It was often remarkably simple. Kevin's use of telephone company vernacular snowed most customer service operators whose full cooperation he needed to, say, pull a victim's toll records. And some of Kevin's freaking tools came in handy for Lenny. The telephone company's loop lines, the special numbers it used for testing customer service, were ideal for certain tasks. For example, when Lenny and Kevin applied for jobs and needed to supply a reference, they could give out a test line number, sit on the line waiting for the call, and give the reference themselves. And they made frequent use of phone company test numbers that provided a constant busy signal or simply rang and rang. To them, it seemed more like harmless hoodwinking than fraud. Free long-distance calls using credit card numbers were perhaps the best part of Kevin's freak repertoire. But when Lenny tried to show his father how to cash in on the free service, he got a stiff reprimand. Computers were Lenny's abiding passion. At 15, he was still too young for his driver's license, so on weekends and school holidays, his father drove him to the nearby Northridge campus of California State University to use the school's computers. Lenny usually asked to be picked up 6 or 7 hours later. The senior DeSico understood nothing of Lenny's fascination with computers and things technical. Occasionally, Lenny tried to explain things to him, but his words sailed over his father's head. Gil DeSico had grown up in the 1940s and 50s, when relatives would shout into the telephone to make themselves heard on long-distance calls. Gil didn't see much to celebrate in this so-called computer revolution of the 1980s. If anything, he lamented the loss of communities as he understood them, where people met in person and not electronically, and where teenagers did more than sit in front of computer screens. He was sad to see that young computer enthusiasts felt more comfortable interacting with machines than with people. He was a humanist who prided himself on having nothing to do with these machines. Still, he knew enough to guess that Lenny's computer fixation would land him a well-paying job someday, so he was glad for the time Lenny spent inside the Northridge Computer Center. Lenny had told him that he had made many friends there, and although he spent a large portion of the day playing computer games, it was keeping him off the streets. But when Gil got a call from the campus security office one Sunday afternoon saying he should come retrieve his son, who had just been caught illegally logging on to the highly restricted administrative computer used by the school, among other things, for recording grades, he was sure Kevin Mitnick had something to do with it. Kevin Mitnick was, in fact, Gil DeSico's worst nightmare. Lenny had never shown much interest in school, but he usually managed to bring home fair grades. But when Lenny started hanging around with Kevin, his grades took a dramatic plunge. Gil had only met him once, but there was something unsettling about the overweight teenager. He was always whispering things to Lenny in front of others. This guy wasn't just a bad influence. He was hurting Lenny's chances of ever making good on the future Gil was trying to give his son. First, Gil admonished Lenny, trying to impress on him how lucky he was that Cal State Northridge hadn't pressed charges. Furthermore, he told him, he didn't want to see him spending time with Mitnick. The senior DeSico then decided to take a rash step and see to it that his son's unwholesome friendship with Kevin Mitnick ended. He went to Froman's and confronted Kevin. "Look," he said, "just stay away from Lenny. It's doing both of you no good." Gil didn't want to see Kevin's face around the DeSico house again, he told him flatly. From the dull expression on Kevin's face, Gil figured he might as well have delivered his speech to the nearby bowl of half-sour pickles. Kevin shrugged and smiled, avoiding eye contact with Gil. Okay. I've got to get back to work now, he replied, and turned away. Gil had no illusions that this little chat made any impression. Now that Northridge was off-limits, Kevin and Lenny spent weeks at USC, building up their own small empire of purloined accounts. They had managed to get accounts on all the university's computers. When they arrived one evening as usual, they saw that of their 6 accounts, all but one had been disabled. It was obvious that someone in the computer lab was on to them. Lenny was worried, and he warned Kevin that it was probably a setup. He wanted to leave, but Kevin wouldn't budge, insisting that they restore their lost accounts and that they stay on campus to use the university's own high-speed links. In the end, Lenny shared Kevin's delusion that what they were doing was undercover work worthy of a Hollywood spy thriller. Brazenly walking onto the campus was the kind of thing Robert Redford would do as the hunted CIA researcher in the movie 3 Days of the Condor, Kevin's favorite movie. It told the story of a former English literature graduate student hired by the CIA to extract plots from novels, who stumbles onto a conspiracy within the agency. In one dramatic scene, Redford masquerades as a telephone lineman and throws the agency's high-tech surveillance gear off track by crossing some wires. And Lenny's own code name was Falcon, after Christopher Boyce, the young TRW employee and protagonist of the book The Falcon and the Snowman, who in the mid-70s fed the Soviets secret military technical data that traveled over TRW's satellite communications system.